Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
I do think we need that as a piece for our puzzle, though. Who was Tanavast? Like, what kind of a person was Tanavast? Because we've talked before about how honor seemingly by definition should be good, but there's ways to overdo honor or ways that honor can become not great. So how did Tanavast wield the shard of honor?
Welcome back to Following Know It on a Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 242, and we are in chapters 46, 47, 48, and 49 of Winded Truth. Elliot, how are you?
I am surviving. The day we recorded this is the day after Daylight Savings, which is wrecking me a little bit. But it's fine. I'm here. I'm awake. Let's do this.
Not to be pedantic, but it is the day of Daylight Savings, not the day after. Paul, how are you?
Okay, yes.
I was thinking the same thing, Trevor. Not. I wasn't actually going to say it, so yeah, I guess you are the pedantic one here. But yeah, today is Daylight Savings, so a bit sleepy, had a very brief nap to try and compensate, and we'll see how it goes. But doing really well. I feel like I'm at this point in the book where things are getting exciting, but we're only like a third-ish, roughly, of the way in. And I'm like, this is a big book. This is a large book. And I feel like I'm starting to feel the gravity of how big this book is. So, yeah, I guess I'm excited to talk about these chapters and keep on moving forward. Got a long journey with this book.
Kind of similar to that, I actually read my physical book for one of these chapters. I know that's crazy for me. But what I did realize when I read my physical book for maybe like the first actual time, there is no header or footer or anything on the page. They had to fit so many words on the page. That's a bad example. That's a title page. There's no like Wind and Truth at the top. There's no, like, the page number is next to the words, not below them. Like, they fit as many words as physically possible on the page, on every page. And I noticed that as I was reading, and that surprised me. Elliot, had you noticed that?
I don't think I did, but I'm also used to reading the mass market paperbacks, which kind of do the same thing because they're trying to crunch in as few pages as possible to put it out for the lowest price point possible. So that's kind of common in the mass market paperbacks too.
Sure.
Just full size pages this time, full large, right. Large pages of text. Yeah.
This is a giant.
We're almost 50 chapters in. Not including interlude chapters, right? And I'm like, yeah, that's got to be halfway through the book, right? Like 50 chapters in, you know? And nope, we're not near halfway yet. So,
all right, Paul, do we have a patron?
Yes, we do have a patron. I'll jump right into that right quick. I'm very excited because it's a really cute username, in my opinion. Apologies if that's rude to call your username cute. I don't know how to do this. So we have a new surgeon this week. Very exciting. And I have quite a big jar here as my cup. It's roughly the size of my head, I feel like. Roughly. Maybe it's a little smaller than my head. And it says, cook, serve, and love on the jar. This was a wedding gift for my wife and I. So yeah, there you go. I'm running out of options here. And we have our lovely patron, our surgeon, Little Shark. So we're very appreciative of your support, Little Shark. I think that's a really fun name to write down. So thank you, Little Shark. And always remember to cook, to serve, and to love. So there you go. There you have it.
Thank you. Thank you, Little Shark. Question, Paul. Did you put that on your wedding registry or did someone just get that for you? Because that's very like cottage core, like mug. Alex into that?
So Alex is a bit of a cottage core style decorator, I would say. However, this was just a gift. It was just a gift. It was not on the registry. So someone just thought this is what they need. And it's like a utensil holder. It's not a large cup. It's for, you know, your kitchen, all your, you know, cooking and serving and loving people when they're at your, you know, the vibe.
Gotcha. All right. Elliot, let's do brief summary before we do two words this week. See how that rolls.
Okay. Hold on. I gotta finish reading the Google search for cottage core. I'm learning what that is. Okay. Now I know what that is. A return to traditional rural fashion boomer life. Okay. Anyway, boomer. Ha, you're funny. Okay. Chapter 46. Navani is watching the giant portal open and people come through. Wit comes through. A bunch of heralds come through. Trying to figure out what the heck is going on. She sees a singer that she apparently recognizes. I really want to talk about that. Dalinar recognizes Yezrian and goes, whoa, that's my old drinking buddy. Lots of mind-blown moments, I think, in this chapter. Wit starts to get really weird when they start to talk to him. Yeah, we'll get into it. Chapter 47 jumps us back to Adolin, who's leading the defense inside the Azish Dome that we analyzed so in-depthly earlier. And the singers who are attacking them have managed to build their own fort inside of the dome, soulcasting it to bronze. So now we've got a full-on like city versus city siege thing almost going on. The second half of chapter 47 jumps over to Sigzil's point of view, which I've been enjoying those. We haven't gotten too many of those in the past, and he is prepping for assault at the Shattered Plains with his army and the other army of Fused that they know is on the way. Chapter 48 goes back in time to Zeth, and Zeth and his family are sent off to become soldiers. Zeth, because he's killed someone and has subtracted, and the rest of his family because they volunteer to go with him. Chapter 49 is Shallan and her crew, which includes Renarin and Relaine. They show up at the big portal scene. I'm dubbing it the portal scene. And they are trying to figure out what's going on. They're trying to track down Mraes. Shallan does track down Mraes, has a little scuffle with him before they kind of get dragged apart, has a run-in with Formless. And that's kind of where we leave Shallan. And 49 wraps up with Dalinar talking to the Stormfather. Stormfather says, hey, you want to get out of here? And Dalinar says, no. End of 49.
All right, Paul. Out of that summary, do you have two words that stuck out to you in these chapters?
I do. And I'm kind of proud of my words. My two words this week are revisiting history. And I originally chose the word revisit, and I kind of just made it all go together because of, you know, we have Zeth flashback, and largely with Shallan being revisited, if you will, by Formless. Quite an ordeal. I'm excited to talk about more, or more devastated to talk about, because it made me kind of sad. But we'll get to it. So revisiting, and then also we are literally revisiting history. We are seeing the heralds before they became heralds leading the people onto Roshar, which is a huge moment. Like the start of the Alethi on Roshar is like quite the historical event, and we're getting to witness a little bit of that. We're getting to see this portal open up and people start to stream in, which is pretty awesome. So revisiting history.
Elliot, how about you?
My two words for these chapters are familiar faces, for probably all the obvious reasons. We've got Formless, we've got Sigzil POV, we haven't had him in a little while. We've got Dalinar Navani recognizing all these people coming out of the portal, like Yezrian and Chanarach and Shalash and Wit. And yeah, I think I was mostly, oh, Shallan bumps up against Mraes yet again. Only person I couldn't quite work into that was Adolin. So sorry, Adolin.
All right. Let's talk about 46 first. Two main things I pulled out of here. If you guys have more, you can add to them. First is Chanarach. Second is Yezrian, to me, in this flashback chapter. Dalinar is a bondsmith. He's trying to go do his bondsmith thing of, hey, let me touch you on the shoulder so I can understand you. Yezrian, being an old-style surge binder, is like, no heckin' way am I going to let you touch me. You are glowing. I know exactly what that means. Stay away from me. And neither of them can understand each other as they're doing this. That made me think. I was actually kind of fascinated by the heralds coming over from Ashen. Seemed to already be surge binders. We knew that was probably going to be the case. Without bonds and without Spren, without ideals. Do you guys think that's something that we're going to be exploring in this book? Or are we just establishing that as a possibility for later, like for the back five? Are we going to explore limitless surge binding in the Wind and Truth or not?
That's actually a really good question I hadn't thought about. We've talked about some of these historical events we might see. But I'm going to go out on the limb and say I think we will see it. I think we will see at least hear about it. Maybe not necessarily like looking and seeing in a vision, but maybe the heralds, maybe we hear from them in their state back at this time where they're more sound of mind and hearing from them about what was happening. I think we will. I think that'd be cool. It's been alluded to enough that I think it's fair to have that information in this book. That I feel like it would even in the back, if you look at the back half, my guess is that it'd even have to be reset up again. I feel like it could come in here, but I'm not that attached to that. It might not be what's on the docket, but yeah, I think we could absolutely see or at least hear about this limitless surge binding. I think that'd be cool.
I think it's going to come up again in this book because we've also touched on a couple times the origin of Spren. Where did they come from? When did they come into the picture? I think it's even mentioned in one of these chapters here. They're looking around and going, hey, there's not a lot of Spren here. They must have not learned how to attract to humans yet or something that effect.
It's in 46. Navani makes that up. Specific observation of Spren must not be keyed into humans yet or something like that.
Yeah, so I think all of that points to we're exploring the creation of things, the time at which things start to happen, the crossover from free range surge binding to, no, let's put some rules on this. I think it's going to come up.
And to be clear, I guess this should be stated. We've already kind of explored that with Honor Blades. You know, like Zeth in the first two books is running around surge binding and Syl's like, oh, he shouldn't be able to do that. He needs a Spren. But I'm more wondering if surge binding is fairly commonplace as these people are running through the portal. Or is it just our heralds? And why is it just our heralds at this point? Like, I'm really curious to know what was happening 2 hours before this portal opened up and who and how we opened up this portal. You know, has Ashen been burning for a while? Or did it just explode? Like, what? People are on fire walking through this portal. That seems a pretty sudden event, not a gradual one. So that's where my brain's at.
Yeah, I think you're right. The one last thing I want to say is I feel like we've begun to see more evidence or hints that I feel like our heralds don't really have the right rules or the right things going on, or at least with surge binding as we know it. We know that surge binding on Roshar has been based with the Spren, but I wonder if the heralds and the people then came from a time when there were no rules, no Spren, like you just went out and surge binded. I guess don't know how or when or why or what, you know, but I feel like that has been a subtle point thus far, and so I think it would be fair if we learned about that, if we got like closure on that. This seems like the time that would happen, is while we're faced with a huge group of our heralds, at least in the spiritual realm, not physical, but at least a time where they make a little bit of sense, they have a little bit of logic, you know. So yeah, I think we could absolutely see that. But and also continuing onward, I was so tuned in and loved this chapter. I didn't know what we'd be seeing in the spiritual realm. And I knew we'd see some major historical events, but I did not expect this. It feels like a treat. Like, this feels like a awesome moment that we get to see that I did not expect we would get to see. But watching the heralds all stream in through this portal is I was so excited. It even took me back to the Way of Kings, when I was so excited to meet our herald characters, and then you finally meet some and they're just speaking gibberish and insane. I'm like, this is our chance to go back and to know what they were like, in a way. So I was really excited with this. This got me really looking forward to more.
It's a very different kind of reveal or experience for me in a Stormlight book, because it feels like a lot of our previous reveals were big, oh my goodness moments, or big shocking reveals, or lots of new information was dumped on you. I feel at this point we know so much, or at least we've theorized on so much. There's no single part of this where I'm pointing to say that's incredible or that's shocking. There's not actually anything shocking here. It's more just soak it in, just experience it. We've theorized about this. We've talked around this for so long. And now here we are standing in the moment, witnessing them step up through the portal from Ashen onto Roshar. It's cool in a experiential way, not necessarily a shocking revelatory way.
You crushed it. You crushed exactly what I was feeling, but I don't think I was describing well. I kind of got chills during this because, yeah, it's like we've known of this for so long, but I didn't expect to get to see this.
Right.
And it's awesome. Yeah, you're right. It was awesome to experience.
Something I had on my brain during this scene of finally getting to see this, I was trying to think of how long in real life I have been waiting to see this. And the answer is 8 years. I read The Way of Kings 8 years ago. And you guys read The Way of Kings almost 5 years ago now. It made me think, comparing it to somebody who reads Stormlight straight through now, or in 2 years, or in 10 years, like picking up the Cosmere for the first time, you read Stormlight 1 through 5 straight through in 6 months. I'm like, the amount of time I had to wait for it, or even Tim had to wait for it. Tim read The Way of Kings the year it came out. Like, the amount of time that Tim has had to wait for a scene like this versus someone who just picks up the Stormlight Archive now is such an odd concept to balance of. If you're just reading the Stormlight Archive straight through, I don't think this scene would be. What's the term you used, Paul? A treat. I don't know if this would be as awe-inspiring for someone just reading Stormlight straight through.
Trevor, I think you make a fair point, but I will say you might be underestimating how long it may take to read these books through one time, even if you are just reading straight through. And, you also got to say, if someone's reading along with our podcast, then they've definitely spent plenty of time mulling on this.
Right.
That this probably had some awesome payoff. But you're right. Like, the real amount of time that many people have waited to see a moment like this is, it's kind of funny to think about. You're like, yeah, I've waited 8 years.
Yeah.
To see something like, well, this. Like, that's a long time. That's a good while. Yeah.
And it was this scene that really gave it to me with that context, but we'll have plenty more of those scenes in this book. We've been waiting so long for so many scenes that are coming in this book, but if it just gave me the, I've been still getting more of like my coworkers and stuff into the Stormlight Archive like recently. And then they're like, oh yeah, I finished book 5. And I'm like, that's not fair. Like, you started reading a year ago and you're done. That's not fair. Anyway, Navani, in chapter 46, she has this really, like, offhand single-line comment. She sees a singer in the group that's investigating the humans coming through the portal, and she's like, huh, that one looks familiar. Moving on. I'm like, okay, well, hold on. okay. Raboniel is my first thought. It could totally feasibly be Raboniel. But I got a little bit more into it and was thinking, what if this is like an unmade, but pre-being unmade? What if this is like Ba-Edo Mishram? And then it made me think, okay, has Navani seen any unmade? Is there any ancient singer that she would have heard of in lore or seen a depiction of, or, you know, something like that, like the author of the Dawn Chant, maybe, you know, something along those lines where she could have seen in Vorin religion that she would recognize other. But I mean, obviously the first one is Raboniel in my brain. Did you guys come up with anything else?
I didn't really go any other directions other than when I read the chapters through the second time and I was taking notes, I was watching for this and specifically watching for if she came back to this, because it's a single line, a single sentence. And I don't think it ever comes up again. And by the end of this chapters we've read here, we're focused on other things.
And we've left the scene by the end of these chapters. So
Yeah. And so this totally feels like a Brandon Easter egg buried in here of rereaders are going to poke at this or realize what she just noticed here. And first time readers aren't even going to notice that this sentence is there. I feel like it has to be Raboniel. That's the singer that she knows well. We spent an entire book with the two of them going back and forth, getting to know each other, building relationship. If there's anyone she's going to recognize, surely it's Raboniel, right?
Okay. You'll say that. And that's an excellent guess. That is an excellent guess, Raboniel. I feel like she would not say, that singer looks familiar if it's Raboniel. I think
that's where
she
I am, Paul.
Recognize Raboniel enough.
Yep.
You know, it's very possible that Raboniel looks very different at this time. But I think if this was Raboniel, who I don't anticipate to have more impact on our story in this book, I think it would be like a reuniting or something moment that could still happen. Actually, that's not out of the question that she could maybe talk with this singer, and it is Raboniel, and they kind of have like a little chat. I don't know, that'd be interesting. But I think, honestly, my guess, which I don't have a great explanation for, but my guess was that this is Venli, because I feel like we have to see Venli at least it's somewhat some form. But I was like, I don't know if they've ever made contact. The question I had, which I'll ask y'all and will probably get proven wrong right away, was, so there was the group of singers in the prologue situation that we always see from a different perspective, right? Group of singers that came and met with Gavilar. Was Venli in that group?
Yes. But she's, so the key thing you're missing here, Paul, before you get too far with this, Venli's not alive yet. Venli is fairly mortal and was born relatively recently. But are but are fused, such as Raboniel or Leshui or the Pursuer, those guys would have been around feasibly around this time.
Okay. That makes sense. My the reason my mind went there was not fully out of logic, but out of wish. I want to know what Venli is up to. I want to see more. So that was I was like maybe there's something there. Maybe it's a nod, but I think Elliot is right that I think if we reread this book after we finished it, we'll probably laugh at ourselves and be like, "Oh yeah, it's this."
I'm with you though, Paul. I feel like if it was Raboniel, she would have said so, and she would have seen it.
Well,
because she recognizes the heralds for who they are, and she's spent most of her time with Raboniel over the last 2 months. Like,
Raboniel is also 5,000 years younger in this scene.
Sure.
Whereas the heralds are only
that's true.
Like 10 years younger, because they kind of freeze in time. They even talk about this, right? She's looking at Shalash and she's like, oh, she's 10 years younger than how we know her. But what if Raboniel, if this really is Raboniel here at this moment in her original singer form, this is aged 5,000 years Raboniel, because she's been reincarnated so many times and tortured and twisted and
Yeah, that is true. She would be in a different body, but you can still kind of recognize who they are, but they definitely look different every time they come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is getting a lot more Mary in my mind, because I'm also trying to think of, like, Trevor, you threw out the name Baed O'Mishram, but I'm wondering, would, like, this singer to Navani is familiar looking, but she can't quite tell. And I'm like, I don't think she would know what Baed O'Mishram looks like and be like, yeah, that's who that is, you know.
And
it's possible. I think it's still possible, but I don't think so.
And that's the conclusion I came to as well. I doubt Navani would recognize any unmade, even pre-unmaking, whatever that means. I've got no idea. But I am under the assumption, I'm making the assumption at this point in history that we're looking at, the unmade are yet to be created and they are just normal singers. That's my guess.
Honestly, if I had to put my chip somewhere, I would actually go like the route of saying that this is Leshwi and not Raboniel.
Okay. Because
I feel like there's ways for Leshwi to still like to still maybe have more meaningful impact, I guess. Because we know that Leshwi is somewhat like loyal to the Radiance in a way. Like we kind of had a moment of realization in the past about that. So it could be interesting to see them come like them at this time where the heralds are coming through the gate and like. Yeah, I don't actually know where to go with that, but I feel like there could be something set up with Leshwi's character, which would be cool.
I'd be on board with that. Leshwi mentioned that she has a soft spot for Windrunners. She used to know some Windspren back in the day, like before everything went south. So yeah, I could see it being Leshwi. Anything else from Fortress? Oh, Wit.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about Dalinar real quick. Dalinar recognizes Yezrian as Ehu. So I spelled out for you guys way back in like Oathbringer or maybe Rhythm of War who Ehu was, his drinking buddy from Oathbringer. And it's just now that a reader who didn't necessarily have that spelled out to them gets that reveal. So the old drinking guy at the back of the Kolinar Palace, Ehu, is Yezrian, and Dalinar's like, what? What?
Dalinar had the reaction that Paul and I had when you revealed that to us back a few books ago.
That was one of the craziest reveals to me, as a side note, like that. Because, I mean, you hear like Yezrian, whatever, was like the, it's like the most revealed herald name or whatever, like in world. So it was crazy to like learn that this is the, because we see the conversations with Ehu and it's just rambling drunkenness nonsense.
Is it?
Well, I mean,
you that's know what how I mean. It's portrayed, but is it?
Yes. Well, yes, I understand. But, like, you know, the drunkard character who hangs out this, like, back alleyway was the king of the heralds. Like, that's a wild realization. I bet Dalinar is absolutely reeling, like, after that. That's nuts. I also want to point out, I think it's wild we get to see Yezrian again, because we got confirmation earlier in this book that he's for real gone. Like we thought we already came to terms with he's been killed and is gone, and then they brought it back up and we're like, yeah, he's in the sphere. Like, we're gonna now just smash the sphere. No hope for him. And yeah, but we get to kind of re-see him in history, and I'm frankly excited about that. Like I said, I've always wanted to talk to the heralds, like the heralds as they would have been, you know, like the noble herald characters. And we might get a chance. It's a bit weird, especially if we're about to talk about Hoid. You'll see why that might be complicated to do so, but we might also see some really cool stuff. But the spiritual realm is certainly odd with talking to people, I think.
And it's not just Yezrian here, too. He has Ash with him, who is his daughter. Did we know that already? We probably knew that already.
We did know that already.
Okay.
I didn't. I'm sure y'all did, but wow. I had no idea.
That was one of those things that gets mentioned in these chapters, and I was like, whoa, really? And then the more I thought about it, I was like, okay, we probably knew that already. And Chanarach is here, too.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to add a little bit of 49 into this discussion. I am reading with the full assumption that Chanarach is Shallan's mother. I am completely convinced. Like, that it is not an if, but a when for me. I am so convinced. So here's how I read this chapter, 46. I read the chapter. I saw Chanarach show up. And I was like, okay, we, Navani and Dalinar in the same area as Chanarach. There's some development. Skip down to 49. Shallan shows up in this vision with Dalinar, Navani, Yezrian, Shalash, and Chanarach. And I'm like, all right, here we go. It's happening. And just a little bit more perspective for me. Paul read this chapter before I did. So Paul puts in the live reaction this huge long paragraph that has been spoiler marked on chapter 49. And so I see this. I don't read it. I see how long his reaction is to chapter 49. And then I'm like, going into 49, it's Shallan's point of view of a scene where Chanarach is. And I am so convinced that Paul has already reacted to this. This is about to happen. Okay, Shallan shows up. Chanarach is like a couple hundred yards over there. And there's nothing. There's nothing. Chanarach is right there walking through the portal, talking to Navani. Shallan is over there doing her thing in chapter 49. And there's nothing. I was astonished that we did not get a Shallan like, that's the lady who tried to kill me when I was 8 or whatever. I was fully expecting it and incredibly surprised when it didn't happen.
Wow. I'm sorry that my spoiler marked paragraphs led you astray on that one, Trevor. But you are right. I feel like the fact that she does not see Chanarach in this chapter, in my head, that's the confirmation. Like, why, if it's not going to be some, like, she sees Chanarach and is like, that's my mom.
Yeah.
If that's not going to happen, then yeah, Chanarach strolls through the portal and she's like, whoa, that's the herald. Chanarach or whatever. And they go about their day, but she didn't. And so I'm like, okay, there's definitely something setting up here. Whether that's going to be Shallan seeing and just having a big reaction to herself, or if it's, I could even see it happening where like she just like turns around and she's there and they're like instantly confronted into like a conversation or something. Like, I feel like this was the confirmation, but without the actual confirmation scene.
Sure.
In my head.
And when this happens, not if, I'm actually really curious how dialogue is going to go, because Wit in this chapter speaks as like current day and past day Wit.
Yeah.
Past day Wit is like, oh, I don't know that yet. I haven't sent you here yet, but I'm sure I will one day. And you're like, whoa. Wit is like a self-aware past tense something like dude. And we can talk about Wit in a second. But if that is applied to Chanarach and like they actually have a conversation between Shallan and Shallan's mom, that could get crazy.
Well, hold on. Here's a half-baked idea for you. In 49, Shallan has a confrontation with Formless. What does Formless say? Formless says, you are what you were made into, Shallan. You are what was done to you. That is me. I am your future. Is that happening because Chanarach is there? If Chanarach is what happened to Shallan, is that triggering this?
Like Shallan sees it but doesn't tell the reader,
right?
And like doesn't tell her own mind that she sees her mom?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, oh my goodness.
Now that's some, I was about to bring that up, Elliot. I can't say I love that scene because it's very tragic, like very sad to see Shallan go through all of this. But like it's brutal. Like that really like drug me along. Like the whole like you are what was done to you and like digging up this trauma for Shallan.
Yeah.
But I did not consider this. I did notice that Chanarach was notably absent, or at least not yet seen, or whatever, from Shallan's perspective. I did not consider that to be a possibility, and that would be crazy. For me, that complicates a little bit of what was happening in Wind and Truth. I guess, sorry, in Words of Radiant. No, hold on. Rhythm of War.
Loading? Apologies. Hold on.
yeah, loading. with Formless. But that would make sense of the things that happened that were done to her and that were in her past, obviously still having weight and haunting her today. And then she did a good job of dealing with that. And then it would be natural for that to flood back in as she sees, which would be crazy. That's a wild one of like, if she sees Chanarach, who would be her mother, assumedly, but instead of actually seeing her, she's confronted by Formless, would be
really... It re-triggers that Formless identity.
Mm, wow. Okay. I also want to say, it wasn't like a bingo board thing, but I did say whenever we got our people sucked into our characters sucked into the spiritual realm, I definitely was saying that they're going to be confronted once again with some of the biggest struggle points they've had. And I feel like that's been true so far. And I feel like y'all dissed me, so I will be accepting apologies.
Did I diss you? I don't feel like... I don't remember that.
I'm joking, but I feel like that's been the cadence of it so far, at least with Formless being at the a major conflict in this chapter. And I feel like this isn't going to stop. And we had stuff with Dalinar before, I believe. So, yeah. If only. I, of course, did not have that on my bingo board because I had no idea we'd be seeing the spiritual realm. That was not on our bingo boards. So.
Yeah. Let's stop and talk about Wit for a second. Navani and Hoid, and she calls him Wit, which I actually kind of, I'll stop there for a second. I actually kind of had an issue with that. He would not be called Wit at this point. He is not the king's Wit. He is Hoid or Sephandrius or whatever he went by on Ashen or whatever. But he responds to Wit, which might actually trigger this like past tense and future tense Wit talking to Navani at the same time. I don't know if there's a literary term for this, but he is a self-aware, like, imagination thing that he explicitly tells Navani, like, I don't know that yet, or something like that.
And it starts to break the code of the Matrix, pretty much.
Yeah.
Because they start talking to him, he becomes self-aware as not real and literally starts to melt.
Yes.
his face starts to melt. And I'm getting Matrix vibes of he's the anomaly in the code that they just accidentally disrupted. And now, you know, they're seeing like green lines of ones and zeros instead of Wit.
Yeah, he also shows up as his like real self, not his Roshar self that he has changed into, I guess. And we've seen this before in the Yasna point of view chapter where they're, you know, sleeping in bed and he jumps up and he's his old self and yeah, you know, whatever. But yeah, I noticed that too of Wit getting really weird and didn't really know what to think of it yet. I assumed Wit would act fairly normal in these visions, and he's absolutely not.
There is a fun factoid buried in here, which I'm not seeing it on the page, but I wrote it down in my notes. If you're a Hoid aficionado and you're trying to unravel the mystery of that is Hoid, it is stated in here that at this point in time, he's 3,000 years old. I don't know what to do with that, but it's a data point.
It is a data point. 3,000 years at the time of humans showing up on Roshar.
Yep.
Interesting. So if we get a data point between humans showing up and the Oath Pact being broken, then we have a full timeline because we have a data point for that.
I think he tells someone somewhere that he's 10,000 years old. But that might even be like Tress that I'm thinking of, actually, where he says that. So he tells somebody he's 10,000 years old somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I think he tells Kaladin that.
Maybe it is
the Dog and the Dragon or something like that. Okay. Anything else from this whole scene? We can close it with Dalinar, but before we do that, anything else that you guys found?
The only other Shallan thing would be fighting with Moraes, which there's not a whole lot there other than she notices him, they fight, they get separated, moving on.
Yeah. So in 49, and then we'll go back to 47 and 48, in chapter 49, Dalinar has a discussion with the Stormfather. And the Stormfather asks him, hey, do you want to get out of here? I'll give you a second chance. And Dalinar says, no, I need to find the lies that you've been telling me or something like that. And then the Stormfather's like, all right, peace, I'm out. What are we going to see? Final chips on the table of what is Honor hiding? What is the Stormfather hiding?
The line here is really interesting to me. it's, they're like getting pulled apart or something. The Stormfather is disappearing, and Dalinar shouts at him, "What lies have you been telling me?" And the response back is, "Only the ones that you deserve." What does that even, what does that even mean? I don't even know how to think about that.
That's a great question. Is that, is he talking specifically to Dalinar? Is he talking to humans as a whole? Is he talking to, is that
it's
honor talking, or is that the Stormfather talking? Like,
it's also a straight up acknowledgement that he's lying.
Right.
Anyway, so, yeah, there's something here that we've got to go uncover. What is the Stormfather so desperate to hide from humanity? I don't know. Did honor do something not honorable? I don't know.
That's what I think. I think honor broke his single definition and therefore got shattered, not necessarily got killed by Odin.
Oh. Huh.
That would be my guess right now. I think honor died by his own hand and then let humans down, if you will.
Or, like, I could also see a scenario where Odium tricks him into that scenario.
Sure, sure.
Of he gets, like, baited into doing something dishonorable and explodes himself.
I think I like that train of thought. I feel like I would mostly agree with that. The main question for me is I still just don't understand the Stormfather.
Sure.
Like, I still don't, like, same. Like Elliot, you said, this whole, like, I tell you the truths that you deserve or things like that. And, like, we know for the prologue that the Stormfather has been around Gavilar. Like, I don't know. There's just so much weird stuff that I feel like has really come in this book. It's been really weird with the Stormfather. And this whole, like, Dalinar's here to get the power of honor. And the Stormfather's like, well, you can't want the power of honor. You're unworthy. Like, I don't know. I'm really struggling to make any predictions on this because I can't really tell. If I have to make guesses, a final guess. Man. I feel like this is the thing. This sounds like this is kind of a cop out. I think this is going to be like the big reveal, like the big, like you never saw it coming type of reveal. That's going to shake how we view the shards on Roshar and honor as a shard and Tanavast. Selfishly, I really want Tanavast point of view at some point because that would work for my bingo board, so I'm going to
convenient
that as well, because that helped me out.
I do think we need that as a piece for our puzzle, though. Who was Tanavast? Like, what kind of a person was Tanavast? Because we've talked before about how honor, seemingly by definition, should be good, but there's ways to overdo honor, or ways that honor can become not great. So how did Tanavast wield the Shard of Honor?
And I'm very keyed into, at this point in history, Tanavast is alive and well. Like, Tanavast is fully functional shard of, or vessel of honor on Roshar doing his thing. We've got to be able to learn something about him because he's, you know, he's leading the singers on Roshar as far as we know. So I assume that the Stormfather is set up to cover up whatever happened to honor, go give a select few people throughout history these visions, put honor on a pedestal, blah, blah, blah. But I think something happened to honor of his own doing. That's my guess.
I think you'd be right. I'm going to throw one other like crazy prediction out here. And I wonder if the honorable choice for the Shard of Honor to take was to die, like was to be destroyed. And it was like a, I don't know, you know, we're looking at this whole contract around the Contest of Champions with Odium, right? And if Odium breaks the contract, there are serious implications to that, right? But this is all hypothetical. But, you know, if something happens where Odium, I guess, feels or is required to do something outside of that, then you've basically got him. Like, you've opened up the Shard of Odium to destruction, you know? I'm wondering if a similar thing happened. You know, we've talked about Dalinar at the Contest of Champions facing somebody that he's unwilling to kill, unwilling to fight, right? I'm wondering if a similar thing, that situation actually happened with Tanavast, where for whatever reason had to break or basically choose self-destruction over doing something dishonorable. I think that's the honorable route. Chose, like elected, if you will, to be destroyed. There's the very possible dishonorable route where it was honor was actually not so honorable as we might think. So I'm kind of leaning towards rooting for the good side, but like I said, the Stormfather, I feel like, is making it impossible for me to make any serious judgments. Like, I don't know anything because the Stormfather is, I don't even know what he's doing. He's just making everything that you think you're getting clarity on. He's like, nope, not that. Nope, that was a lie. And nope, you're not worthy and you got to stop looking.
Yeah. I just got to get this soundbite out there in case I'm right. Honor isn't all he's cracked up to be, whatever that means. I think it might break Dalinar, and Kaladin might pick it up. So when we find out that Honor isn't who he said he was, whatever that means, it might break Dalinar. It might break everything Dalinar thinks he stands for, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it might not break Kaladin. I don't have any specifics for you, but I'll put that out there in case I'm right and I sound really smart. Okay. Chapter 47 and chapter 48. We can go through these fairly briefly. Adolin gets the first half of chapter 47. He is in some cool action scenes on our Aesir Oathgate. And the singers have got a foothold at the center of the Oathgate with a bronze dome. Surprise, surprise. They have created a baby bronze dome in the middle of the big one and set up a fort. Did you guys catch the details of how they did that? I thought that was an odd inclusion from Mr. Sanderson.
It did. It was an assumption.
Yes.
I believe Adolin assumes that they're using their feces to, maybe not theirs, but someone's feces to fill in the gaps of this wood, and then soul casting that to bronze, which was crazy. And I have to really give it to Elliot. I think you were the one who pointed out the stolen soul caster. I could be wrong. If it was you, Trevor, then I sincerely apologize. But I think Elliot was the one to point that out and say that we think that's either they're going to, I think the assumption was maybe they were going to turn the whole dome into water, right? The whole big bronze dome into water. But instead we see wood
which still might happen casted
into bronze. So that's true. Well, that's not another question yet. But right now, they're just making their own bronze fortifications out of wood. So there was a direct reason for that soul caster being stolen, which I would have totally missed. I'm glad we have this podcast. I would not have caught on to that right away.
Elliot, you're a big world building guy. Did you enjoy the detail of feces being stuck together to build a dome?
I mean, gross, but sure. you're at war. You got to come up with something if that's what is going to hold your fort together and then get soul cast. I guess a creative.
I mean, it at least doesn't stay.
Right.
Sure. Right. Like, you know, like it's a temporary pain for a longer term gain, you know, so could be worse.
I wonder if our Soulcaster guy survived, or if they just like, and they forced him to Soulcast the dome, or if they just killed him and took his Fabrial.
I mean, that's all it is. It's just a Fabrial, right? If you know how to operate it, anyone can, right?
Right. So I wonder if our dude survived or not.
I think if he did survive, which I frankly don't think he did, I'll just throw that out there. Yeah, I don't think they brought him out here to do it. I think they just took his candy and ran.
We get our first Sigsil point of view in several days in chapter 47, and he is the leader of our Shattered Plains battle that it seems to be about to kick off. He has half a chapter to set up failure points in their defense. He goes through a little bit of an engineering discussion, but with some of the other military generals, and says we should defend four plateaus instead of the two we need, and deliberately give those up as time goes on, because all we need to do is buy time here. So let's expand our borders to more than we need, and then we'll slowly retreat and not draw the lines closer than absolutely necessary. Elliot, what's the last thing that you saw designed with specific failure points in it?
I did think of a couple things with these intentional failure points. I think Sigsil is thinking about this the way you might design a bridge, which mainly, in general, it's a bad practice to intentionally design failure points into whatever you're designing. Just want to say that as engineering starting point. But if you've got something giant like a bridge that is going to be carrying like lots of people on it all the time, you want to know it's going to fail before it does so that you can fix it. So what you might do with your bridge is design a small, less essential part of it to make sure that that less essential part will break first, and then regularly inspect your bridge so that every month you go out there and when you see, oh, shoot, this little beam over here is broken, that means the rest of my bridge is going to fail in the near future. I need to fix it all. So it kind of can give you a warning of what's coming. What I actually thought of that I have some more experience with is in aerospace engineering, we do a lot with valves. You've got lots of different propellants and commodities and things, helium and hydrogen and oxygen flowing through different systems. What you can do with a valve is specifically design it to fail in a way that you want it to be less catastrophic. So you can have fail open valves and fail close valves. So if like you've got helium flowing into your system as like a safety purge, helium's nice, noble gas, doesn't burn. You can make things safe by just kind of flooding it with helium, as long as there's no humans there, because humans can't breathe helium. So dangerous for humans, really safe for non-humans. So you might want your helium system to have a fail open valve so that if something fails, at least you're getting more helium than you wanted as opposed to less. And maybe in other more dangerous systems like your liquid hydrogen, maybe you want that to fail closed so you don't create a explosive atmosphere with a big deluge of helium or hydrogen or something like that. So that's a way to kind of intentionally design your thing to fail in the way that you want it to, which I think is what Sigsil is trying to do here. He's saying, I'm going to intentionally set up a slightly weaker position so that I can anticipate how I'm going to fail and how the enemy will advance, because they're going to chase through the weak points of my defense.
I just learned so much. That was awesome.
sorry, no visual this time.
That's great. I was thinking, as soon as I heard this, I was very curious to hear your thoughts, Elliot. I was wondering if this was, I assumed it was a real thing, but I was wondering about the practicality of it. It's neat to know. I thought that was a really cool concept. And I've been wondering, do y'all think that this will work successfully? Because I feel like it's very plausible that this could be set up. And then, you know, it's setting up to understand and anticipate where the failure is going to happen. I feel like in a lot of stories and a lot of these big moments in the Stormlight Archive, things might not go according to plan. And so I fear that maybe our fail point might be okay, and the fails might be somewhere else, which could be a bit catastrophic. But I also feel like this is a really cool moment in that it's going to work. I honestly think I'm more like, I'm 60%, I think this is going to work. I'm 40%, ooh, I don't know, what kind of gimmick are we going to face? What kind of, how is this going to go wrong?
I don't think I would use this strategy in battle. It's got some decent uses in engineering, like I was talking about, and it might work the way he's thinking, but you've also got to have extra expendable soldiers in order to do this, because you're basically saying, I'm going to set up in a suboptimal defensive position so that I take losses. I just take them in a way that I can predict. That feels like the strategy of, I have more soldiers than the other team and can afford to lose some.
Right.
Which I don't think is a position he's in.
Yeah, I think the Shattered Plains is going to go way worse than the battle planners here are assuming. Ever since the invasion of the tower, where we had the deepest ones crawling through the stone and like choking soldiers from the floor, applying that to the Shattered Plains here, where you're just coming up from beneath your plateau and, you know, strangling you from below. Epic, by the way. I think this Shattered Plains fight is going to go quite poorly. I will be honest. They might buy enough time for our listeners to come writing in on Chasm Fiends to the Riders of the Rohirrim by Howard Shore, which will happen. But I think we're going to lose way more than we're expecting before that happens.
Question though, do they have any light weavers in the midst? That might not be information that we know.
Yes. The majority of the Knights Radiant that are battle ready are here on the Shattered Plains.
Okay. Cause my thought is, like, Elliot, you made a great point. I'm like, yeah, I don't feel great. What if you're told, yeah, we need you to station at this post? This is going to be the post that we're going to position a little bit poorly so that we can maybe they'll focus all on you guys, leaving our other places in a better winning position. You know, I'd be like, no, I think I'd like to try somebody else.
No, thanks.
On this mission. I'm wondering if, and this might not work well at all, especially for the light weavers, but my thought is, what if you almost stack your forces elsewhere and either that or have some kind of like hidden preparations and then have the supposed weaker structure light weaved, like have your light weavers fabricate a weaker setup where they're not swooping the whatever they might be up against, heavenly ones or whatever. People swoop in and invade, and you're not yet losing real soldiers. You're baiting them in with light weaving, and then you can fight back or push back or something, I guess. Because I've very much given Sigzil the benefit of the doubt. I don't imagine Sigzil's going to really put a, yep, you guys are all going to martyr and die for the greater good on this plateau, like on this area. I don't imagine Sigzil's going to really set that up. I'm very curious to see how this actually looks, because I feel like there's going to be more than that simple. We're going to structure poorly, and you know, he is going to make this a strategic breaking point. But I don't imagine it's going to be a massacre. Or if anyone is there, it will be him, he himself. Like, he will be there to, almost like the Dalinar philosophy of, you can't ask someone to do something you're not willing to do. I don't know. I'm giving Sigzil a lot of the benefit of the doubt here. Who knows what might happen? It does not seem like it will be very good. But who knows? We don't know yet.
If my limited knowledge of war history here, there's plenty of great generals in history, in quotes, that have designed, say, the middle of your forced to bulge. That way you can then surround the oncoming force that pushes forward too far. I'm thinking of the Punic Wars. That there are plenty of good of examples in history of generals designing soldiers to fall in battle so that the enemy shows up where you want them to on the battlefield. So I imagine that's where this is coming from Sanderson. So, all right. Chapter 48, the final chapter for the episode, is a Zeth flashback. Fairly short. I think it's like 6 minutes or 9 minutes on Audible. And it is Zeth the day after or the night after he has killed the soldier from day three. And his father is talking with the shepherd. No, is that right? The farmer? The farmer.
Farmer.
Is his father talking with the farmer? The farmer saying, your son has to go away to war now or to be a soldier. And his father volunteers with him, which could have been guessed at as a plot point based on what we know of Zeth's family. But still a great scene. I really enjoyed it. Having Zeth's father volunteer with him and his whole family by the end of the chapter. A great scene. What'd you guys think?
You're right. This was a pretty quick chapter. Some of the things that were cool in this, so we're just seeing the aftermath, like you said. The farmer, so obviously Zeth's father is pretty shaken up, livid about the whole situation. Like, he's coming to grips, he can't really quite believe his son subtracted, right? And I was very grateful that the farmer here was kind of allowing for a little bit of common sense. We know the Shin people to be pretty rigid and definite thus far. But he was like, Zeth has strangle marks and cuts around his neck from this man who just tried to kill him. It wasn't like your son was viciously premeditating murder. You know, he was ultimately in a moment acting in self-defense initially, right? But Naturo is kind of in disbelief at this moment for a while. So then these things go on, and Zeth ends up volunteering or somewhat being recruited into the whole the army or whatever, right? Isn't that where it goes? And then Naturo is like, take me with you. I'll go too. Yeah. Doesn't want to send his son off alone, which I thought was pretty honorable from the dad. I feel like we have dissed Naturo a bit. there's been some interesting questions of the standards, the questions that he's put on Zeth, and whether or not that is great. I don't even know what to make of it. I feel like I'm officially resigned to. I can't right now. I like Naturo. I'm interested to see what happens, and I think he will be integral to Zeth's story, of course, as his father. But I'm very curious to see what our opinions are of Naturo at the end of the book. Like once this wraps up, like in hindsight. Is he like one of the best characters in the book, or is he like questionable? I guess I really happen to like him, but I'm also known for really liking Zeth and everything involved with Zeth's story. So maybe it's not fair, but
my feelings about Naturo changed a lot based on this scene. You're right. I think earlier on we did get a little bit on him, mainly for, at least in my mind, for not taking responsibility for the rock and kind of putting that responsibility on his 11-year-old son. And now here, he seems to, without a question, without hesitation, volunteer to go with Zeth into a life that they know is not going to be great as a soldier, as a he who subtracts, and for him to immediately jump to, well, this wasn't his fault, I'm going with him. He just jumped up quite a bit in my esteem.
From very early on, when we get Zeth's point of view in either The Way of Kings or Words of Radiance, we get Zeth going by Zeth son Valano, not wanting to dishonor his father's name because he's been named Truthless and he views himself as this horrible person. So we knew that Datura was a good guy, at least in the eyes of sane Zeth. So yeah, he jumped up for me as well.
This particular act reminded me also of someone else that we know very well, and another instance where someone was being drafted, if you will, into the military and someone volunteers to go with them. And of course, that person is Kaladin with his younger brother, Tien. Did you guys get that vibe off of this chapter too?
I did, yeah.
It's kind of the Hunger Games moment, if you will. Yeah, kind of.
I volunteers
tribute. Yeah, exactly. One person, the more innocent of the characters, the more naive of the characters getting essentially drafted or an unfortunate event, and then the Kaladin, right, the older brother, the protector, the father in this situation, volunteering. I think that's, I'm a little bit of a sucker for that. Like, it's such a good moment. I'm very curious to see how this progresses. I didn't expect this. I honestly was afraid that this would be the start of Zeth's questionable ethics and understanding here getting worse, and it could very well be, but I was expecting a little more of, like, you know, Zeth is now disassociated from his family or something after this, like that it's fully he's being ripped from them or something like that. So I'm very curious to see where this goes.
Anything else?
I think this was a really awesome set of chapters to read. I don't have anything else specifically, but I wanted to point that out. I think this was a lot of fun. We get a lot of perspectives in this episode. You know, Dalinar, Navani, Adolin, Sigzel, Zeth, and then Shallan
Dalinar
and company at the end. Yeah, Shallan, Dalinar at the end. Like, it's a wide range of stuff happening all at once, and it all happens to be really epic. Like, all four of these chapters, I think, are pretty spectacular. So, yeah, I've been loving it.
Same. Good stuff. I'm excited for more.
All right. Next week, we have chapters 50, 51, and 52 to cover, still in day 4. So let's reconvene next week. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
Later.
Toodles. See you next week.